Hello, listeners, and welcome to the Sounding Jewish podcast. I am your host, Dr. Samantha Cooper, and each episode presents my conversations with musicologists, ethnomusicologists, and sound studies scholars who specialize in the music and sound of Jewish experience. I am absolutely delighted to welcome you to today's episode featuring Dr. Jonathan Branfman. Thank you so much for agreeing to join me on today's episode of the Sounding Jewish podcast. I would love to give you the chance to introduce yourself.
Thank you so much for having me. My name is Jonathan Branfman. I'm a scholar of Jewish media representation and especially Jewish racialization and gender performance in US pop culture, always rooting that contemporary analysis in the longer history of anti-Semitic bodily stigmas and Jewish performance traditions. And I currently hold two positions. I'm a research associate with the Hadassah Brandeis Institute at Brandeis University and a lecturer in Jewish studies at Stanford University.
Fantastic. Can you tell me about one of your earliest encounters with Jewish sound, music, or media, and what made this such a formative experience for you? And in particular, what kinds of personal or musical experiences motivated you to want to study Jewish media?
Sure. So my earliest exposure to Jewish music was probably in my synagogue growing up, in synagogue preschool or kindergarten. But I think the experience that has stuck most deeply and still strikes such a chord is my experience attending Jewish summer camp, specifically URJ Camp Harlem. And as some listeners may know, there's a very specific soundscape to American Jewish summer camps. And I'm sure there are variations in all the different movements and even the individual camps. But even now, on the occasions when I'm able to find a song on iTunes that has those melodies, it really resonates for me in a different way than the melodies I know from synagogue.
Are there any particular melodies that come to mind when you think about Jewish summer camp?
Yes, there are, but I don't trust my voice well enough to sing them. But some of the nigunim, also even the tune to the Birkat Hamazon and the particular shortened Birkat that we grew up singing after meals, it still sometimes surprises me that if I want to, it'll all come right out from memory, even though I don't consciously remember all the words.
Love that. Can you tell me a bit about your scholarly trajectory and how you decided that your initial research topic was the one for you?
Sure. So I did my undergraduate degree at Washington University in St. Louis, majoring in history, minoring in French and women's gender and sexuality studies. And after that, for 2 years, I worked in the nonprofit world, for example, at the Human Rights Campaign. That was my very first office job out of college. But I eventually realized that I wanted to go into academia. And so I applied to PhD programs in women's gender and sexuality studies and was accepted at a few places and chose The Ohio State University. And it really was a great intellectual home for me for many reasons, including the flexibility with which the department supported my emerging focus on Jewish topics, even though that was not a central focus within the department. So I completed my PhD work there and then did a visiting assistant professorship in gender studies and film studies at the College of William and Mary, and then a visiting assistant professorship in Jewish studies and English at Cornell University. And now I've just finished up a postdoctoral fellowship in Jewish studies at Stanford University, and I'm beginning this research associate position in Jewish gender studies with the Hadassah Brandeis Institute at Brandeis University. Something I've really valued in that path has been the chance to wind through different fields and different departments and continue gaining a better sense of what it is to be simultaneously a scholar of gender studies, Jewish studies, critical race studies, and media studies. So I initially did not see myself in the field of Jewish studies or intend to write about anything Jewish. I actually began my PhD in gender and sexuality studies. And over the course of that PhD, I found more and more that I met people who very earnestly wanted to make the world a better place and were very committed to thinking about many different angles of identity and injustice, but who really didn't have tools to think about Jewishness and anti-Semitism. And in some cases, I encountered folks who were very resistant to thinking about anti-Semitism and sometimes could deny that it was a real issue. I remember once saying to somebody, "Gosh, I've noticed that in our field, we don't really talk about Jewishness." And the person said back to me, "Oh, but John, in the US, being Jewish gives you status," which of course is itself an anti-Semitic myth. And so through these encounters, I realized that I wanted to provide tools for the fields of gender studies and critical race studies and Jewish studies to better speak about contemporary Jewish experience and especially how it intersects with race. And I eventually came to the topic of popular culture as a way of providing those tools. And sometimes people say to me, pop culture seems sort of a frivolous entry point to such serious issues, but pop culture provides really vivid and personalized examples for topics that can otherwise seem so abstract and distant. And an example I always give, if I I'm talking to students or friends or anybody, and I ask them, "Are you familiar with the idea of racial anti-Semitism? And do you think racial anti-Semitism impacts how you see the world?" Often people will say no, or just look at me in total confusion, really not certain what I'm talking about. But then if I show them a picture of the film star Zac Efron and say, "Does he look Jewish?" almost universally, everybody will burst out laughing and say, "No, definitely not." And then I can say, "Interesting, how come?" And then people will say, "His hair is so light, his eyes are so blue, his nose is so small, he's so handsome, he's so buff." And so then it turns out that these folks who thought they didn't know anything about racial anti-Semitism actually have a very specific catalog of notions about how Jewish bodies are supposed to look. And once we've established that realization, then we can start asking, where did these ideas come from? Historically, where have they emerged from in terms of art, theater, literature, religion, and pseudoscience? And how have they come to shape our daily perceptions, including for many Jewish people? So that's an example of how pop culture can give us an entry point into these really serious real-world issues.
Yeah, I definitely hear you. And I think the follow-up question from a sound studies perspective would be, how do we know what Jewish bodies are supposed to sound like? Right?
Yes, and there's a really interesting history of that. Very often in the US today, we think of racialization only in terms of skin color, or at least in terms of concrete bodily traits, like maybe including hair texture. But historically, one major racial stigma on Jewish bodies has concerned the voice. There was this notion in 19th century racial pseudoscience that Jews supposedly had distinct facial muscles and throat muscles, which would supposedly produce distinct Jewish voices, voices that sounded incurably foreign, and voices, particularly in men, that would sound feminized or gay or sing-songy. And this idea of distinct Jewish voices is still with us in US pop culture today. One big example came in 2014 on the sketch comedy show Saturday Night Live. There was an episode with the guest star Drake, who's a biracial Jewish rap superstar. And the first sketch reenacted his bar mitzvah with SNL actors playing his family. And one important character is a Jewish Uncle Barry who speaks with an exaggerated, quote, Jew voice.
Uncle Barry, I have a gift, you know. In the Jewish tradition, we always give money in multiples of 18. So here's your very own savings bond for $18.
And in fact, in German, historically, there is a word specifically for speaking like a Jew. It is Mauschelm. And although I don't speak German, I believe I've read that this verb also means to cheat at cards, which is a very interesting connection. And one of the things I write about in my recent book is that in order to understand how racial anti-Semitism works in the US today, we have to think about how skin color intersects with these other dimensions of racialization. For instance, how a Jewish person with white skin could simultaneously experience color-based privilege and experience forms of racial stigma related to their voice or the motion of their body or their performance of gender or sexuality.
Yes, definitely. For listeners who might not be aware, can you share the title of your recent book with us?
It's called Millennial Jewish Stars: Navigating Racial Antisemitism, Masculinity, and White Supremacy. And it came out in June with New York University Press.
Awesome. Congratulations.
Thank you.
So, at what point in your career did you come to Jewish media studies?
So I came to Jewish media studies probably in the third or so year of my PhD. And keeping in mind that this was within a gender and sexuality studies PhD, I was very fortunate to have support from faculty who did not necessarily specialize in this topic, but who were willing and able to think creatively about how to support me. So, for example, I'm always very grateful to my doctoral advisor, Linda Mijayevsky, whose specialty is in star studies and representations of gender and sexuality in film, including she has written about Jewish stars like Sarah Silverman and Fanny Brice. And so I am always grateful for how she encouraged me to go in this direction, even if it was not firmly within the specialty of anyone in the department. And I'm especially grateful to Linda for encouraging me to focus within the realm of media studies, specifically on star studies. Basically, star studies is a thread of media studies which analyzes how individual stars come to symbolize broader ideological issues, national hopes and fears. For example, I think even listeners who've never watched a Western are probably familiar with how Clint Eastwood or John Wayne have come to symbolize a certain fantasy about white American masculinity, and then sometimes to represent anxieties about the supposed decline of that masculinity. And Linda encouraged me to consider how particular Jewish stars become kind of lightning rods for wider ideological issues that often have very little to do specifically with Jews or Jewish experience. And one reason I'm grateful for this lens is that many people, particularly non-Jewish readers, may assume that Jewish topics are sort of provincial, that they are only of interest to Jewish readers. But in taking the star studies approach, I really found, and I hope that my book shows, that anti-Semitic stigmas don't only serve to hurt individual Jews or Jewish communities, they also position Jewish bodies on screen as symbols that are kind of ripe for representing wider ideological debates. For example, how stigmas of Jewish emasculation can make certain Jewish male performers into striking symbols for wider American fears about emasculation, the supposed emasculation of white presenting men, or how stereotypes of Jewish women being, quote, improperly feminine can sometimes position Jewish women performers as feminist symbols who are able to break certain boundaries of gender and sexuality on screen. A great example of how tropes about Jewish womanhood can position some Jewish women as feminist icons is the TV series Broad City, which ran from 2014 to 2019 and starred Abby Jacobson and Alana Glazer in a kind of semi-autobiographical tale as young women enjoying their 20s in New York City. And in one particular scene, Alana and her mother are enjoying kind of a tender conversation on the sidewalk after the shiva for Alana's grandmother. And when they're having this moment, some jerk yells at them and tells them to get out of the way, get off the sidewalk. And they turn and unleash their rage at him. And they're yelling in these voices that match stereotypes of loud or, quote, shrill Jewish women. But whereas usually those stereotypes serve to villainize Jewish women or present Jewish women as unhinged, instead their rage is presented as well justified. And they even become a kind of avatar for many women who've experienced harassment on the street and maybe felt like they had to stay quiet. Instead, here are these two Jewish women using their loud, stereotypically Jewish voices to tell a man that he doesn't have the right to treat them that way.
Hey, you're blocking the whole sidewalk.
So the hell around you us, you patriarchal mother. What
do you think you are
you?
Talking
you
to us that
around
way?
Us, face. Murder you,
you cross
little
the
bitch.
street.
And I found, in fact, that the stars I write about come to represent a wide range of issues, everything from class mobility, fatherhood, motherhood, drug use, millennial well-being in the post-recession world, issues of national security, issues of sexual violence, issues of reproductive health, and more.
Can you tell us a little bit more about your most recently completed research project, which I'm guessing is this book? Why you selected this project? What has excited you while you've been working on it? And where you see yourself going next?
Sure. So my most recent project is the book Millennial Jewish Stars. And music emerged as an interesting thread within the book. It was not originally my intention to focus on music, but several of the best known self-identified Jewish performers in America are musical performers, such as Drake, the biracial Jewish rap superstar.
I've asked about you and they told me things, but my mind didn't change. I
the same. What's a life with no fun? Please don't be so ashamed. I've had mine, you've had yours. We both know, we know. They won't get you like I will. My own.
And so, alongside analyses of film and dance and other aspects of Jewish performance, I had to pay attention to the way that millennial Jewish performers were integrating histories of Jewish music, sometimes including like references to Fiddler on the Roof, both through melody, but also through choreography and gestural vocabulary that goes with the music.
I wouldn't have to work out. If I were a bitty, bitty rich, idle, diddle, diddle, diddle man, I'd build a...
I also had to consider an aspect of music that is maybe not always considered Jewish music, but the history of Jewish performers appropriating from and or participating in Black performance traditions. And there's a particular Jewish history of that, which is not always considered part of Jewish music, but I would argue is. One of the most prominent and problematic examples is the 1927 film, The Jazz Singer, starring Al Jolson, in which he appears in the racist performance tradition of blackface and both appropriates and caricatures African-American styles of music and dance.
Mammy, mammy, I'd walk a million miles for one of your smiles on my mammy. Mammy, my little mammy.
On one hand, even when I've analyzed Jewish musical performers like Little Dickie or Drake, there have not been that many moments when they're very clearly referencing Jewish musical traditions, such as klezmer. But in a way, those choices are also interesting and speak to the management, the public management of Jewish identity. Because if we think of every part of a public performance as a choice, and frequently a choice made by a team of producers and designers and musicians, the choice not to draw on certain musical traditions is just as interesting as the choice to draw on them. So for instance, Drake, early in his career, has a music video from 2012 called HYFR, short for, quote, Hell Yeah Fucking Right. And the music video reenacts his bar mitzvah. But what's so interesting is that most of the music in the video, and in fact, I would have to rewatch it, but it might even be that none of the music in the video at all draws on any Jewish musical tradition, but certainly the majority of the video does not.
She feels obligated, admitted it to me the first time we dated, but she was no angel and we never waited. I took her for sushi, she wanted to fuck, so we took it to go, told him don't even plate it, and we never talked too much after I blew up, just only hello her, happy belated, and I think I text her and told her I made it, and that's when she texted me and told me she prayed it, and that's when I text her and told her I love it, and right after text her and told her I'm faded, she...
And that musical choice fits into a broader pattern in the music video where there's this disconnection between the choice to set this music video at his bar mitzvah and within a synagogue, but then actually to include very little Jewish content on any level, whether in terms of costumes, religious practice, anything else. Rather than approaching that decision with any kind of judgment, it's just interesting to analyze what pressures is Drake navigating as a Black Jewish Canadian rap star who got his media debut in a cheesy Canadian soap opera playing a sweet artistic middle-class student in a wheelchair. And how does he try to take all these aspects of his image and make them cohesive in a world that considers these different elements to be fractured or incompatible with each other? In terms of what I found most exciting about this writing process, it was realizing how these individual stars really tap into much wider social issues that affect everybody, both Jewish and non-Jewish. And as I was writing page by page, realizing that I'm not just writing a book about these individuals, nor just writing a book that will be interesting to people who follow them or who want to hear about Jewish success in popular culture, but that in fact, this book is speaking to the very foundations of racial, quote, common sense in America, the way that people perceive bodies, including their own bodies, and how they plug those bodies into wider ideological schemes. On that note, I will say something that I found painful in the process and that still makes me sad is that I think many people who really need to read this book won't read it because they'll see the word Jewish on the cover. I think that even as this book contributes a great deal to Jewish studies, I hope that it contributes an equal amount to the fields of gender studies and critical race studies. And I think that sadly, many of the people in those fields who most need these lenses because they are so deeply overlooking these issues will assume that a book like this has nothing of value for them, or may in fact look at a book like this and feel a sort of rejection or dismissiveness towards it. And that makes me sad. But all we can do is put tools out there and then people will make their own choices about what to read or use. In terms of future projects, the next book project I have in mind is called Passing Fancies: Jewish Specters and Chimeric Liberation in U.S. Passing Films. So it will look at a wide range of films about passing, meaning concealing race, gender, sexuality, religion, or in some cases, concealing mermaidness or alienness or androidness. And in the past 5 years, I have designed and taught a class about passing films and found really interesting motifs that stretch across a range of different passing films that are often imagined as unrelated, such as films about racial passing versus Jewish passing versus sexuality passing. And so I'm interested to put all these subgenres in conversation in a new way. Off the top of my head, I'm not certain what role music may play within that project. Certainly, music is often used as a subtextual cue to indicate a person's, quote, real identity or the identity they're trying to take on. And so that will be an interesting angle to consider as I think about similarities and differences across these passing films.
Wonderful. How would you say that your interest in the study of Jewish media shaped your experiences in graduate school? And what advice would you offer to prospective students or new scholars who are thinking about entering this field of study?
One piece of advice is to use a citation tracking tool like Zotero. It is very, very useful, and I cannot even imagine how I would have done the citations for my dissertation or my book or any of the articles I've written since without it. But specifically writing about Jewishness and Jewish pop cultural or musical performance, I encourage people to read widely in fields that may not always seem like cognate fields, such as gender and sexuality studies and critical race studies, because even when those fields may not know that they're providing tools for thinking about Jewishness, sometimes they are. And particularly for thinking about Jewish racialization and how it may interact with other cues, such as music or gesture. I also encourage students to consider how important it is to have a community of mentors. Every different mentor brings a different insight. There's the person who can tell you what you need to cut from your article, and the person who can tell you what you need to add to your article, and the person who gives great feedback on job application letters, and the person who gives great feedback on institutional culture in different institutions. So even though, of course, during a dissertation, often the primary mentor is the doctoral advisor, and it's very important to find the advisor who's right for you, it's also important to build a community network. And that also, by the way, includes peers, because peers can also share really valuable insight, especially as we all move through our graduate programs and then into our professional careers. Along the way, people gain experience with editing journals or going through the book publication process. And so really value the insights of your full community.
Yeah, I love that. And this is the perfect segue for me to ask you who some of your biggest mentors or advocates or role models throughout your scholarly journey have been.
Sure. So alongside Linda Mijaevsky, my advisor, I'm very grateful to Treva Lindsay, who's another scholar at The Ohio State University, a Black feminist scholar who very kindly shared her time and insight specifically and particularly for my chapters on Drake and Little Dicky and their performances of race and masculinity in rap. I'm also very grateful to my friend and colleague and mentor, Lynn Kay, who actually was the first person to suggest that, hey, maybe the Association for Jewish Studies might be a good fit for you, perhaps a better fit than the annual Gender Studies Conference. And I remember going to AJS for the first time and being like, oh, yes, I feel the fit. I also greatly appreciate Russell Mioff, who is another scholar of star studies and who has given great feedback and mentorship over the years. Certainly at every university where I have landed, in the years since my PhD at the College of William and Mary, Cornell, Stanford, I'm very grateful to the mentorship I've received in each place. For example, from Richard Lowry at the College of William and Mary, Caroline Levine and Jonathan Boyarin and Deborah Starr at Cornell University, Charlotte von Robert and Steve Zipperstein and Shana Hammerman here at Stanford, and there are many others as well.
What methodological models or tools do you find yourself most often using? And how and why would you say you developed your appreciation for them?
Good question. So STAR Studies takes the approach of looking at many, many, many different types of imagery by and about a star. So rather than just, for example, watching a star's movies or their music videos, you watch basically everything. So not just the movie, but the interviews about the movie and the tweets about the movie and the comments on the YouTube videos about the movie. Same thing for YouTube videos. Some of the most interesting stuff out there about Drake, the rapper, is actually not just in his music videos, but in the comments underneath when people make all sorts of ignorant comments. Invariably, there are comments expressing surprise that Black Jews exist. And that sort of thing. Or for example, with the rapper Little Dicky, who is a white presenting Jewish rapper, he has a very interesting music video called White Dude that's all about his white privilege.
You can't even wanna wait to boy, cause the way I'm living life is a motherfucking joy. On some grown man B.I. I could have been a girl or any ethnicity up in the world, but I'm rolling with the top bag. I ain't gotta worry where the cops at. I ain't gotta wear a fucking bra strap. Me and the crew are really doing everything that we like to. Man, it's a damn good day to be a white dude. Shit, I'm living good up in this bitch.
But then in the comments underneath the video, there are several white supremacist commenters, such as one with the name Fashmaster, as in fascist master. And they comment things like, quote, he's not white, he's a dirty Jew, unquote. And so seeing that interplay between different materials by and about a star is part of the methodology of STAR Studies. So it does take a lot of time and a lot of entries in Zotero, but eventually you reach a kind of saturation where you realize that every new interview you're watching or every new comment you're reading is actually repeating themes that you have come across many times before. And then that's when patterns start to emerge that you can write about. And so it can seem sort of amorphous. It's not as straightforward as like, we watch this or we do this experiment and then this comes out. But I can say now after publishing this book that it really works. If you collect enough material and you look at it carefully enough, evidence-based patterns do emerge that are really worth writing about. And I find this approach particularly rewarding because I think that if we only focused on, quote, the products, such as a music video, a film, a TV episode, that we would really be missing key insights about how these materials get consumed. So for example, I don't have the sociological training, at least not yet, to sit down and do a focus group for how people feel about Drake or Little Dicky. But there is really concrete evidence about reception to be found in these kind of ephemera that viewers produce.
Awesome. And I can see those same approaches being very generative for musicologists or ethnomusicologists, in addition to, let's say, archival work or field work, to look behind, as you're describing it, the final finished product, and to figure out how the audiences are responding to it in whatever capacity you're able to. Purely because I'm interested, can you tell me a little bit more about how you kept yourself organized with all of this? Because I can see citing eons of comments on a YouTube video, for instance, to be labor-intensive work.
It certainly is. Something that perhaps musicologists also encounter, but I know I often encounter because I'm writing and teaching about popular culture, is that people, with the best of intentions, sometimes say, your job sounds so fun. And sometimes people perhaps imply that it is easy, that you're just like watching YouTube all day. Well, you got to watch YouTube all day and take notes on it, let me tell you. And so for example, that can mean just a lot of subfolders on Zotero, like a folder for Alana Glazer, and then a subfolder for Alana Glazer's performances versus her interviews versus the comments on the interviews. And then subfolders for like interviews in which Alana Glazer references this or that, like references feminism or references Hillary Clinton. And then same with the comments. And it can also be very helpful to then create a page or a spreadsheet of themes that are emerging with the citations, all of the citations for everyone, so that then when you're like, oh, wait, when did Drake say such and such about his mom and describe her in very Christianized terms as an angel? And then you can be like, oh, at these three footnotes. So that is the approach I took.
That's phenomenal. Many scholars will celebrate the opportunity to teach others as an extension of their research pursuits. Can you tell me a little bit about your recent teaching experiences and how you feel they've contributed to your research agenda?
Absolutely. So the course that I've taught on passing led directly to this book project about passing films. And one thing I've really valued about this class over the years is how it draws together both fields and students who might not otherwise intersect in the same classroom. So for example, in this passing course, because there are films about Black passing and Latinx passing and queer passing and Jewish passing, many students enroll because they see themselves in the syllabus, but then along the way end up learning about each other as well. So for example, that can look like students who have thought a lot about racism and misogyny, but maybe haven't thought about anti-Semitism, learning about anti-Semitism. Conversely, it can also look like some students who are Jewish with white skin who've thought a lot about anti-Semitism, but maybe haven't thought as much about racism, learning about racism or homophobia in a new way. And that's really rewarding to see these different demographics and different fields come together in the same classroom. And it's also rewarding to see in end of semester or end of quarter evaluations, students frequently commenting that they not just that they learned so much, but they learned so much they didn't expect to and that they never thought was relevant to themselves, but they are now excited to go out into the world knowing. So that's one class that I have really enjoyed teaching. Another class that in some ways has been kind of a side project, but one I've really enjoyed, is that at Cornell, I designed and taught a course called Brazil to Brooklyn, Jewish Cultures of the Americas from 1492 to the present. And I really do enjoy teaching about Jewish cultures in transnational context and decentering or de-hierarchizing the usual focus on North American, Ashkenazi, East Coast, white presenting Jewish communities. And certainly music has been one facet of that course. For example, hearing and speaking about musical performances by Latinx Jews, such as the Brazilian Mizrahi transgender pop musician Azucena Azucena. Also, seeing a little bit of Yiddish hip hop or other sorts of musical performances that we may not always associate with, quote, Jewish music.
Awesome. Well, we've reached the end of our interview for today. And so I have one final question for you, which is how you understand the field of Jewish media, and in particular, how you see the role of music and sound within this field that you work primarily in. Subsequently, I'd love it if you could talk a bit about what issues or challenges with your field of study you think scholars today need to remain attentive to.
Great questions. So in terms of Jewish media studies, generally, I think it's great for scholars to treat it as interdisciplinarily as possible. And, you know, like we've spoken about, to really keep it in conversation with gender studies and critical race studies and wider fields as well. In terms of music, one thing that's been really moving for me as a viewer and fascinating for me as a scholar has been a certain evolution in Jewish musical landscapes in pop culture of the past maybe 10 years. Many listeners may be familiar with the fact that up until the 90s or even the 2000s, there were fairly few explicitly Jewish characters in American television or film. And there's kind of been this reversal, especially since the 2000s and 2010s, of many explicitly Jewish performers and shows and movies that proved to be marketable to the mainstream. For example, Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, Broad City, Transparent.
Now it's time to celebrate. Grab a drink and fix a plate. But before you feel too great, remember that we suffered. Nights like these are filled with glee, noshing, dancing, singing, wee! But we sing in a minor key to remember that we suffered.
Being happy is selfish. Remember that we suffered.
You have no idea what pain is.
Remember that we suffered. Hey!
And not only are these media more explicitly Jewish, they also sometimes break new ground for Jewish sound and music on screen. So on one hand, I think we're all familiar with the kind of canned, stereotypical klezmer music that may play in certain movies or TV shows when they want to highlight a character's Jewishness. But a moment that still sticks with me is from the TV show Transparent. I think it was from season three, maybe 2015 or 2016, when the characters are celebrating Havdalah, the end of Shabbat, and they sing this nigun that I grew up with at summer camp. But I had never in my life heard the real sounds of my Jewish sensory experience on screen, and had never even imagined that I might experience such a thing. And even though, as a white presenting cisgender Jewish man, in many ways I receive a lot more representation than many folks do in the US, hearing that sound for the first time moved me and made me aware of a gap that I hadn't even realized was painful. And my hope, as we continue forward with the future of Jewish performance in popular culture, is that there will not only be more and more diverse representations of Jewishness, including Jews of color, Sephardic Jews, Latinx Jews, LGBTQ Jews, but also more and more diverse representations of Jewish music, for instance, including contemporary Sephardic music. And I think that will provide very fruitful material as well for scholars of Jewish music and representation to analyze.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so, so much for your time today. I've loved speaking with you, and I think that listeners are really going to enjoy your episode. So thank you very much, John.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Sounding Jewish podcast. I would like to take this opportunity to thank our sponsors, the American Society for Jewish Music, the Milken Center for Music of American Jewish Experience at UCLA,
and the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee Stahl Center for Jewish Studies.
Tune in next month when I will be joined by Dr. Judith Cohen to discuss her ongoing work on Judeo-Spanish songs and those from crypto-Jewish regions in Portugal and Brazil. Bye for now.